This study in the New Testament book of Revelation is offered for the edification of all students of God's Word by spiritandtruth.org. Professor Andy Woods of the College of Biblical Studies in Houston, Texas, will lead us in this study. It is our prayer that this study will deepen your understanding of the Bible and allow you to draw closer in your relationship with God through His Son, Jesus Christ. Now let's begin our time of study in the last book of the New Testament.
Well, good morning. Once again, my name is Dr. Andy Woods, and I'm a professor of Bible and theology at the College of Biblical Studies in Houston. We have been devoting our mornings together by teaching through the book of Revelation. And we find ourselves this morning in chapter 1, verse 9. John, as we look at the slide there, is entering his first major section of the book. He is told to write down the things that he has seen. And we see that in chapter 1. And essentially what John begins to see is an image of the glorified Christ in verses 9 through 20. And as we advance the slides once again, we see that there are some circumstances. We also see that there is Christ's appearance. And then we also see Christ interacting with John. But notice, if you will, the circumstances, verses 9 through 11. The circumstances, verse 9, is John is on a real island called Patmos. And Day of the Lord, verse 10, is really the content of the book. The Day of the Lord is a time period where God enters human history and settles accounts. And you might recall from the book of Genesis, it described days as having both an evening and a morning. And this Day of the Lord that's coming, that's going to be described in the book of Revelation, has an evening and a morning. The evening is the judgment part of it, but the morning that follows is the kingdom which will come upon the earth following this time of horrific judgment. So there's a reference to the Day of the Lord in verse 10. And then as you look in verse 11, John is told to write down this vision that he is to receive from Jesus Christ and send it to the seven churches of Asia Minor. As you move into verses 12 through 16 of chapter 1, what we discover is we have a description there of Jesus Christ. You'll find his body is described, his clothing is described, and he is manifested in his glorified state. And you find him walking amongst the seven lampstands. Now, verse 20 tells you the seven lampstands are the seven churches. So Jesus is involved very much with his church. He's involved with your church. He's involved with my church. But he was involved very much with the seven churches of Asia Minor. He was intimately aware of their circumstances and their needs. And so consequently, this vision is being directed to them. Jesus, knowing so much about them, wants to speak to them through this vision that he is giving John. And as you drop down to verses 17 through 20, you see John's reaction to this glorified Jesus Christ. Verse 17, John falls down as though he were a dead man. Now, that's not how John reacted to Christ 60 years earlier, when he knew Christ personally. In fact, remember, it was John that leaned his head against the chest of Christ in the upper room, John 13, verse 23. But now John sees the glorified Jesus. He doesn't see the lamb. He sees the lion, and he's terrified. Isaiah, the prophet, back in Isaiah chapter 6 and verse 5, had the same reaction when he saw the glorified God in a vision. He said, "Woe to me, I am undone. I am a man of unclean lips," and so forth. And so this is always the reaction of sinful man when they come into the presence of a holy God. And this is why all of us so desperately need a concept that the Bible calls imputation. Imputation means Christ's righteousness is transferred to us at the point of personal faith in him. There's a chasm which cannot be bridged between sinful man and holy God. The two cannot dwell together unless we have the transferred righteousness of Jesus Christ. And so this is why John is afraid, but it's also why this doctrine of imputation, why Jesus comforts John here. You'll notice in verses 17 and 18, he's comforting John, and then he gives John his command to write down the vision that he is about to see and that he is seeing already, and disseminate it to the seven churches of Asia Minor that John was the bishop over. And as we have said before, verse 19 is a very nice outline for the entire book. And then we continue on and we come to chapters 2 and 3. As we advance the slides, you'll see that we are in the second major section of the book where John is told to write down the things that are. Now, the things that are is a reference to the seven churches in Asia Minor. And as we advance the slides, you'll see a map there. John is on the island of Patmos, and these seven churches are dispersed there in the Asia Minor area. The first church the letter will go to is Ephesus, and then it will move up north to Pergamum. And then as the letter is handed off from one church to another, things will proceed in a southeastern direction until finally the letter will arrive at a church called Laodicea. And I like to call Revelation 2 and 3 the forgotten section of the Bible. Everybody, when they think of Revelation, thinks of the end time judgments and things of that nature. And when we think of the epistles, we think of the letters Paul wrote. But secretly tucked in here into Revelation is our literally seven epistles. Seven letters written not by Paul, but this time directly by Jesus Christ to seven churches. And they are tremendous letters and instructions regarding what a church is supposed to be and how Jesus looks at churches. And I believe what you have here are seven kinds of churches represented. And as we advance the slides, what we discover is these letters all have a pattern to them. The letter begins with the destination, what geographical church is being addressed, and then you have a description of Jesus Christ in each letter, drawn from imagery from chapter 1. Remember, John saw a vision of the glorified Christ. And so Jesus will draw imagery from that and apply it to the church, and it typically will apply to the church's need. Jesus will highlight an attribute of himself to communicate to a specific issue or need going on in the church. And then there's a word of commendation, where Jesus tells the church what they're doing right. Then that's followed by a word of rebuke. He tells them to repent or change over certain things. And that's followed by an exhortation to change, and then a consequence if they will not change, a temporal consequence of some kind. And then an exhortation to listen. It says, to him who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches in each letter. And then there's a promise given to the overcomers in the church. And the material for that promise is drawn from the last two chapters of the book of Revelation, Revelation 21 and 22, as members of that church will get a glimpse of the eternal state, and it, in essence, will encourage them in the midst of their present circumstances. And I believe that the overcomers in each of these churches that are addressed are the believers. And so there are promises to those actually in the church who are Christians and not believers. Are believers. And I believe that because John, in his other letter, remember, John wrote not just the book of Revelation, but 1 John. 1 John 5, 4 and 5 defines an overcomer as a true believer. And so that is, in essence, something that Jesus is giving to those in these struggling churches, promising them ultimate victory. And that's a promise that we all have as Christians. No matter the struggles that we're currently in, we will, in fact, possess ultimate victory as we are related to the victor, Jesus Christ, by way of faith. Now, these patterns that we went through for these letters are not ironclad. Sometimes Jesus will deviate from the pattern just a little bit. For example, to the churches of Smyrna and Philadelphia, which are under persecution, he gives them no word of rebuke. So it is very interesting to me that a persecuted church is a pure church. And so there's no rebuke to those churches. But on the other end of the stick, when we get to Laodicea, there's no word of praise, because that is a totally backslidden carnal church that Jesus is very disappointed in. As we advance the slides, one of the views that theologians come up with is what's called the historico-prophetic view. And this is the view that each church mentioned in Revelation 2 and 3, each letter to each church is actually representative of an age of church history. So, for example, Ephesus is the apostolic church from AD 33 to 64. Smyrna is the persecuted church from AD 64 to 313. And as you see from that chart, it goes through various ages of church history and gets right on down to the modern church. And the modern church is supposedly Laodicea. And that's a very interesting view. I personally don't agree with this historico-prophetic view. As we advance the slides, I'll give you about four reasons why I don't agree with the view. But one of the reasons I don't agree with the view is because of the doctrine of imminency. You know, the rapture is something that can happen at any moment. And yet, if seven ages of church history have to transpire before the rapture, then the rapture is not something that can happen at any moment. You see, the rapture is designed by God to teach people that at any moment He can come and rescue us as members of His church. But the historical prophetic view places all of these ages that first must manifest themselves in the last 2,000 years of church history before the rapture can occur. Another reason I'm not a big fan of the historico-prophetic view is, to me, it seems very ethnocentric. Ethnocentric is where you view the world through your own culture. And here in America, we look very Laodicean. Jesus will rebuke the Laodicean church for lukewarmness. And the church in America, by and large, is Laodicean. But if you go to the persecuted church in other parts of the globe, they are not Laodicean at all. They are on fire for the Lord, probably because they're under persecution. And another problem with the historical prophetic view is it really doesn't fit the era of church history too well. For example, Thyatira is supposed to be the church of the Middle Ages, when the church was in darkness theologically. And that doesn't make too much sense, because Thyatira is being praised because their deeds are increasing. That doesn't really fit the Middle Ages very well. Sardis is supposed to be the church of the Reformation, when the church woke up. But here what you'll notice is Sardis is rebuked for deadness. So historical prophetic view is very interesting. I just submit it to you for your information. I'm particularly not an advocate of it. To me, the historical prophetic view is very allegorical. It's not taking the text for what it says. It's reading a bunch of things into the text that really are not there. And the approach that I'm using here in the book of Revelation is what's called a consistent literal approach. And so I believe that these are actually seven letters to seven literal churches in Asia Minor that were struggling. But as we advance the slides, we have a chart there, and you'll notice what Jesus says to the church at Ephesus. He addresses Ephesus in chapter 2, verses 1 through 6. Ephesus is the loveless church. And Christ describes himself as the one who holds and walks among the seven churches, and he commends the church at Ephesus for their deeds. I mean, these are folks that are busy for the Lord. They're discerning, they're enduring, they're toiling. But he rebukes them because they've left their first love. Somehow, Christian activity took the place of a relationship with Jesus. And consequently, he calls them back to first things, to their first intimacy that they once had with the Lord. And he promises the overcomers in this church, the true believers, that they will participate in the eternal state at the tree of life. And then we also see the church at Smyrna. Now, the church at Smyrna is the persecuted church, and that church is described in chapter 2 and verses 8 through 11. And Jesus describes himself here as the first and the last, that the one that was dead and now is alive. He is the victor over the grave. And this church would need to know that because many of them are about to go into their graves suffering for Jesus Christ. He commends them for their ability to endure poverty and tribulation and persecution. And you'll notice there's no word of rebuke to these folks because a persecuted church is a pure church. He simply exhorts them not to fear death and be faithful unto death. And he promises that they will have victory over the second death, which is the lake of fire, the ultimate form of death, because they are related to Christ by way of faith. And then advancing the slides, we come to a church called Pergamum. Pergamum is described there in chapter 2, verses 12 through 17. This is the compromise church. And Jesus says, I'm coming against you with a sword of my mouth. He praises some of them for keeping the faith, but the problem with Pergamum is they became tolerant of false doctrine. They became tolerant of the teachings of Balaam. Now, when you study Balaam in the Old Testament, Balaam introduced sexual immorality into the traveling nation of Israel. And he rebukes them because they have also tolerated the deeds of the Nicolaitans. Scholars are not sure exactly who the Nicolaitans were. They were probably some group that taught immorality of some kind. And Jesus tells this church to repent or they will experience discipline, a sharp attack from Christ's sword. And you might remember what Jesus did with the church at Corinth and how he came into that church with discipline, some to the point of death because they were disrespectful at the Lord's table. And this church is promised the overcomers a stone, which is represents innocence, manna from heaven, which represents spiritual nourishment, and a new name, which represents a new identity. And then he moves down to Thyatira, which is, I would also call, another compromised church. Thyatira is described in chapter 2, verses 18 through 25. Jesus describes himself as with his eyes and his feet, speaking of judgment. He commends them because their deeds were more than they were at first, but they are also in compromise because they're tolerating the doctrines of Jezebel. Jezebel, you'll remember from the Old Testament, is the character married to Ahab, and she introduced idolatry into the northern kingdom of Israel. Jesus tells this church to hold fast, and he promises this church authority, those that are really in him, authority in the coming kingdom, which he will establish on the earth. And he promises them the morning star. The morning star, when we study it in Revelation 22, is none other than Jesus, a permanent relationship with Christ that they will continue to enjoy throughout the ages. And as we advance the slides, we come to Sardis. Sardis is described in chapter 3, verses 1 through 6. Sardis is the dead church. And so Christ describes himself here as the one who has the seven spirits. The seven spirits, I believe, goes back to Isaiah 11. It speaks of the full manifestation of the Spirit. And consequently, this church needs to get in touch with the Spirit of God. And he praises some because they're not dead, but the ones that are dead, he rebukes them for that and tells them to wake up. And this church is promised to be clothed in white and confessed before the Father. And those are all wonderful glimpses of the eternal state. And then from there he moves to Philadelphia. Philadelphia is the missionary church, and they are described in chapter 3 and verses 7 through 13. He describes himself here, Jesus does, as the one who has David's key. Now, what do you do with a key? You open things, don't you? And you open doors and so forth. And so consequently, Jesus describes himself this way because he is the one that's put in front of this church a massive opportunity for missionary work and evangelism. He praises them because they've endured, despite the fact that they have very little power. You'll notice that there's no word of rebuke to Philadelphia. Why is there no word of rebuke to Philadelphia? The same reason there was no word of rebuke to Smyrna. When you study this letter, you find they were under persecution. And a persecuted church, as we have said, is a pure church. And consequently, he exhorts them to hold fast, and the overcomers in the church are told that they will be a pillar in his temple, speaking of their presence with God in the eternal state. Various names will be written on them, speaking of their identity. And then, if you take a look at chapter 3 and verse 10, it's very interesting. He says to Philadelphia, "Because you have kept the word of my perseverance, I also will keep you from the hour of testing, which is to come upon the whole earth." Now, that is a statement in the sense that this church is going to be kept out of the coming 7-year tribulation period. Ek there means out of completely. They're not just going to be kept out of the test that's coming upon the whole earth, but the hour of testing, the time period. And that time period is described so graphically for us in chapter 6 through chapter 19. And consequently, this is a great verse to promote the pre-tribulational rapture of the church. I believe that this is not just a promise for Philadelphia, but Paul made the same promise to the Thessalonians, and the Apostle Paul made the same promise to the Corinthians. And so this is a promise to the church universal that we will not be present during the events of the tribulation period. We will be raptured to heaven before these things begin to take place. And then advancing the slides just one more time, we come to the last church, Laodicea. That church is described in chapter 3, verses 14 through 21. This is the man-centered church. And it's very interesting that in Greek, the word Laodicea, coming from two words, people and ruling, it speaks of the people ruling. The people were in authority in this church. It's the idea of democracy. God is not in authority in this church. The people are in authority in this church. And so Jesus describes himself to this church as the Amen, the faithful, and the true one, the Creator. So in comparison to their faithlessness, he himself is faithful and true. And you'll notice there's no word of praise for this church. Every church Jesus deals with, he offers some word of praise, but to Laodicea it's different because he sees nothing good taking place in this church. He moves immediately into rebuke for their lukewarmness and their self-sufficiency. These were folks who were priding themselves on the fact that they really didn't need to operate the church according to God's principles because they, in fact, were very wealthy. And isn't it interesting how money does that to us? It deludes us into thinking that we don't need to depend upon God moment by moment. Christ says to this church, "I am standing at the door." And as we advance the slides, we see a picture there of Jesus outside of a door, knocking on that door, trying to get in. And most people present this verse as an evangelistic message. You know, they say Jesus is kind of outside the door of our hearts, and he is knocking on the heart of the unbeliever, trying to come into the heart of the unbeliever, and the unbeliever needs to open the door, and those kinds of things. But the fact of the matter is, this is not speaking of Jesus dealing with an unbeliever. Jesus is outside the door, not of the heart of an unbeliever. Jesus is outside the door of his own church. And as you back up in the verses and go back to chapter 3 and verse 19, it says, "Those whom I love, I reprove and discipline." So who does the Lord discipline exactly? He disciplines his own. And so this is a statement not given to the unbeliever. This is a statement of Jesus outside the door of his own church, which is apostate and self-sufficient. And essentially what's happening in Laodicea is they're having Christianity without Christ. And so it's a scary thing that we in the church world can get ourselves into. We get so active doing things for Jesus that Jesus is no longer in a relationship with us, and suddenly we're governing the church instead of Jesus Christ, and the people are ruling. And you'll also notice something very interesting in chapter 3 and verse 21. It says, "He who overcomes," now he's speaking to the true believers in the church, "I will grant him to sit down with me on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne." You'll notice in verse 21 there that we have essentially two thrones. Jesus Christ, in essence, is not on his own throne, but he is on his Father's throne. Now, where is his Father's throne? His Father's throne is in heaven. But the day will come, future tense, where he will sit on his throne, just as he has overcome and sat down on his Father's throne. So where is his throne? His throne is on the earth. His throne, in essence, is the Davidic throne that was promised to David's lineage. It's described in 2 Samuel 7, about verses 12 through 16. It's a literal earthly throne in Jerusalem, and Jesus will not sit on that particular throne until the earthly kingdom arrives. So he is not currently on David's throne. In the meantime, he is in heaven at the Father's right hand on the Father's throne. And what he promises here in chapter 3, verse 21, that if we are truly related to Jesus Christ by way of faith, we've trusted in him for our salvation, we also, when he takes his seat on David's throne on earth in the millennial kingdom, we also will be ruling and reigning with him. So it's a tremendous promise that we that are connected to Jesus Christ one day will rule and reign with him here on the earth. You see, our ultimate destiny is not heaven. Heaven is part of our destiny. But ultimately, we will have a destiny here upon the earth. In fact, in Revelation chapter 5 and verse 10, it says, "You have made them to be a kingdom of priests to our God, and they will reign upon the earth." Now, the reason it's important to bring up these two different thrones is because many people today are trying to argue that Jesus Christ right now is on David's throne. And they argue that he is sort of orchestrating a spiritual kingdom, and he's doing it from heaven on David's throne. And that's the doctrine called amillennialism, which we described in a prior session. Sometimes it's called postmillennialism. And you'll notice the Bible-believing church is beginning to compromise in our day with this very bad doctrine. And the fact of the matter is, when you study Revelation 3, verse 21, very carefully, you see Jesus is not on David's throne at all. He is currently on the Father's throne, but the day will come where he will re-enter history, establish his kingdom upon the earth, and consequently sit on David's throne on the earth in fulfillment of 2 Samuel 7, verses 12 through 16. And we that are connected to Jesus by way of faith will be ruling and reigning with him. So what we have in chapters 2 and 3 is John is told to write the things that are. And the things that are the seven letters to the seven churches. And we've seen Jesus deal with Ephesus, the loveless church, Smyrna, the persecuted church, Pergamum and Thyatira, the compromised churches, Sardis, the Jed church, Philadelphia, the missionary church, Laodicea, the man-centered church, and we'll see more as we continue.